Welcome to Girl Power History. I'm Alexa Contos.
And I'm Brianna Pirro.
Hey, Brianna.
Hey, Alexa.
How are you?
What's up?
Hey. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good. How about you?
Good.
What's up?
Good.
How was your daughter's birthday party this weekend?
It was good. It was definitely not a party. We played...
Your rager.
Rager. It was four people, five people. We played Nintendo. We played Mario through 3 or 4 or 5D Bowser's Fury. I'm terrible at it. I'm a toad all the time. My 8-year-old yelled at me for being so bad at video games. And then at her request, we ordered sushi, which made me happy. So that was my night and my day.
I feel like sushi was always my go-to birthday dinner when I was younger.
I know, and I'm so glad. I'm so glad that's her pick, because my husband and I, like, we're always so excited because we always order way too much sushi, and it's so exciting. And when it's someone else that's like, I want sushi, we're like, well, if we must.
Yeah.
And then it feels less guilty, like, going all out and ordering everything.
Well, and that's the best part of it. Like, you get a little bit of everything, you know?
All of the time.
The last time so there's a restaurant in Crystal Lake that is called Kyoto, and it's very good, I think, for suburb Chicago sushi restaurant, right? And we went there, my husband and Alexa and her husband, and Alexa's husband is allergic to shellfish.
Kind of.
And I always... Yeah, kind of. I always forget that he's allergic, even though every time we go out, it's like, oh yeah, he's allergic to shellfish. So we like order all the sushi and he still eats it. But I just find it like so funny, and his process is like, well, if my tongue starts getting tingly, that's when I stop.
It's like, hey, I need to slow down.
I need to stop eating shellfish right now. And that is, at least you have your own, like, system, right?
He's got a
system.
I just find it funny. I don't recommend his system. I don't recommend anyone follow the system, but...
Do not follow that system.
He was severely allergic when he was, like, 7 or something. He's not very allergic now. Anyway, he gets by. But he does like sushi,
just funny.
So... And I have to order some stuff that is shellfish, and if he... feels the need to take the risk, no one forced him, and yeah.
Well, he did in Vegas.
In Vegas, I thought he was that was dangerous, but it was good, so I understand. We went to Best Friends, which was at the Park MGM, and it was so good. It's Roy Choi's restaurant. It's just the best food we had. I hope I'm saying this. I think it's Korean fusion.
I thought it was Korean Mexican fusion.
Yeah, something like that. And oh, so it was so good. The place is so cool. All the servers are wearing Adidas tracksuits. And there's just like early 2000s hip hop playing the entire time. And there's a DJ, and the front of the restaurant is a grocery store. And it was just so amazing, but they had something called slippery shrimp that I thought my husband was willing to die for because he ate so much of it, and he's never really liked shrimp before. It's not like a big deal thing to him. And we literally had to have the server take it away from the table so he didn't finish it.
And die.
But I don't blame him. Like, it was really good. I get it. But anyway.
It makes sense.
So, yeah.
It sounds very millennial restaurant.
It was everything. I knew every song. There was Ashanti. There was Ja Rule. I was in.
Ja Rule.
I was, my eighth grade self was in heaven.
Okay. Side note. Bennifer J-Lo and Ben Affleck getting back together. I am not, like, I don't know if it's, I'm not, like, a Hollywood follower or whatever, like, not into that, but, like, I just find them so cute together. And is it because, like, that was, like, our generation of, like, Jenny from the Block, that music video, and I'm like, oh my god, they're back together.
I know. I completely agree with you. I'm not super following celebrities and stuff, but I've read it in the news a couple times. And then I told you last night how I, like, strategically always look up her makeup from that video. And also Scott Barnes, who's her personal makeup artist, I'm also obsessed with. I can never find, like, what makeup was used in that video. And I search for it all the time. And last night, after we were talking about this, I had a huge revelation. And I was like, oh my god. So I was looking for the MAC lip gloss that she used to wear in that video. And then all of a sudden, I was standing in my bathroom and I remembered. And I was like, oh, it was MAC Oyster Girl. So I have
it. If anybody was curious.
Yes, it's a beautiful lip gloss. And it is now ready for pickup at my local Nordstrom.
Is it really?
Oh, I immediately ordered that because I'm like, I'm never going to remember it again.
Oh, that's funny. I'm glad it's still, like, being made today because that was, I don't even know how many years ago, 15?
Yeah, I'd be devastated. But I think it's just nostalgia is kicking in right now, especially, like, after the pandemic. And we're just looking for things that used to make us feel happy. So things like celebrity couples getting back together. It's and even, like, that's, like, so trivial and not important whatsoever. It's just, I don't know, it's just, like, a nice feeling.
Yeah.
So
the world is healing itself.
The world is healing. Everything's magical.
Yeah. Anyways, so yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you had a good weekend.
So how about you? Anything new?
Everything is pretty good here.
Would you say hunky-dory?
Oh, I would definitely say hunky-dory. More the dory than the hunky,
right.
But
all right.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, so I live in Washington State. Most of my family is in the Chicagoland area, and my husband is in the military, so we moved out here like a year and a half ago, and it's just really nice. Like, we moved the moment COVID happened. Like, we moved into our house in February and then COVID happened a week later after we moved in. So being able to connect with people and, like, make a bunch of friends, like, it's been really nice to do that while still COVID's going on. But I feel like I'm finally at a point where it's still happening, obviously, but I'm just more established with my friend group. And it's just really nice to have, like, a ton of support and friendship around me and military. And then, like, just friends that I went to high school with live around here. And, like, my college, it's bizarre. Like, it's such a small world. And you, like, I feel like you don't realize how small it is when you move somewhere that you don't expect anyone you know to be living there. And then, like, a month later, you realize there's someone that lives 5 minutes away from you that you went to college with, or someone moved, like, 6 months while you're living here that you went to high school with. And it's just, I don't know. It's really cool. And all the people I met with the military families are awesome. So it's cool. I just appreciate that. It's been good. So.
Well, I'm so glad you're fine without me. Anyway, let's be done.
I talk to you every single day, Alexa.
No.
I didn't talk to you for 24 hours this weekend, and I texted you on Monday. Are you okay?
You're like, send me proof of life. I'm like, I don't know. What happened? It took me forever to realize that the charging cable that's, like, attached to, like, next to my bed at my nightstand, it's bad. And so every night I would plug my phone in and it'd be dead. And I was kind of just okay with it this weekend. But I finally realized this morning that, like, I'm like, I don't think my phone's charging when I plug it in. And that's, like,
so you were okay without talking to me for 24 hours? I see how it is.
I was like, well, okay, I guess I'm not gonna, like, doom scroll on my phone to wake up in the morning, which has been nice. But then also, like, I kept trying to use my AirPods because I was charging them on the same cord, and I kept opening them, and I was like, you know how you like open them next to your phone and you can see if they're charged? And I kept like doing that and nothing would happen. And I'm just like sitting there like waving these two like electronic things together. And I'm like, I give up. I don't know what to do.
Well, I'm glad you fixed it.
I haven't fixed it yet. I've addressed the problem. Okay, let's make
that. Oh, okay. Well, knowing the problem, step one, admitting you have a problem.
So far, I've resorted to, I have an extension cord that has my Mac charger and a new phone charger. And I keep just carrying that cord around the house with me because that's how I've bandaged this problem so far. So eventually that cord will get plugged into my nightstand. We'll see. I don't know. We'll get there.
We'll check back on this next week.
I'll keep you updated.
Thank God we're all on our edge of our seats.
Thank you.
All right. So it's your story this week.
Yep.
I'm so excited.
Are you ready to get started?
I think so.
All right. All right. So my story today is about Isabella Goodwin. Isabella Goodwin, born Isabella Lowry, was born on February 20th, 1865 in Greenwich Village, New York. Her parents, James Harvey Lowry and Anna J. Monteith, ran a restaurant and hotel on Canal Street in Manhattan. In 1885, she married John Goodwin, who was a police officer. She was only 19, and they had 6 children, but only 4 survived.
That's sad. 6? Like, how did they...
I think that's kind of common for the time.
That time?
Like, you have a lot, because the odds aren't that good.
Well, that is a way. Was it like a, like stillborns, or was it like...
I have no idea. There's not really a lot of... There's a couple times where like stuff like this is going to come up, and I searched so much for information, and it's just like not there.
So okay.
I don't know, but 4 children ended up surviving, so they had 4 kids. All right. So okay. Meanwhile, I'm going to go through... This whole story revolves around the NYPD, and I really found some of this stuff interesting. So I'm going to go through 2 places that are kind of notorious in Manhattan's history of incarceration. I just think that they're really interesting. I hope everyone else does too. If you want to fall asleep, that's fine, but I think these are cool. All right. So the Tombs is a colloquial name for 4 jails in Lower Manhattan in an area now known as the Civic Center. So all of these buildings were, the first they were in 1838 and 1902, it was the New York City Halls of Justice and the House of Detention. That's all one name. That's what it was called. From 1902 to 1941, it was called City Prison, which I feel like is more of like a classic simple title. Welcome to City Prison. Prison for the people. Okay.
Prison for the people.
In 1941 to 1974, it was Manhattan House of Detention, which I kind of think is like Manhattan House of Fashion. In 1983 till now, it's the Manhattan Detention Complex. So it was originally called the Tombs because it was an architectural design of Egyptian Revival style. So it kind of looks like Egyptian tombs. It was built over a pond, which is currently not recommended by today's architects. Within 10 years, the ground began to deteriorate, which resulted in a swampy atmosphere complete with the stench.
Swamp stench.
Mm.
Swamp stench.
Shrek would be quite happy here.
So the prison was over a swamp.
It was essentially like sinking into a swamp.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So gross.
The swamp jail was called the Tombs, and it housed the courts and the police.
Wait, the police were there too?
Yeah, everyone.
It wasn't just for jail.
Yeah, like the courts, the police, and the jail. It was all in the Tombs.
Okay.
So Charles Dickens wrote, "What is this dismal fronted pile of bastard Egyptian, like an enchanter's palace melodrama?"
Oh.
So he was not a fan.
So just of the smell, or just like the overall appearance of the prison then?
I'm thinking all of it. Just all, okay. It all kind of just worked together to be terrible. City Prison replaced the building in 1902, and a bridge called the Bridge of Sighs was built to connect the prison to the Manhattan Criminal Courts building. This building was 8 stories high with a chateau-esque facade, making it a bit more French.
Okay. French New York. Got it.
Manhattan House of Detention came in 1941 with an Art Deco theme and was the northernmost of 4 15-story buildings. The jail is freestanding, while the other 3 towers that house the courts, city offices, departments, and corrections were in the other 3 buildings, and they still called it the Tombs for fun reasons mostly. Like, it was rated the worst of the city jails for conditions and overcrowding. For example, its average number of inmates was 2,000, while it was designed for only 925 inmates, which is less than half if you don't feel like subtracting. Yeah, it was a bit crowded. Standing room only.
That's a little overpopulated.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So in 1983, the Manhattan Detention Complex was remodeled and reopened, which I'm kind of wondering, like, if you're going into a remodeled prison, is any part of you like, ooh, I wonder what it's going to look like? Or is it just, like, horrible because you're still going to jail?
I feel like it's probably still horrible. Like, I feel like the swamp jail or the, like, nicer jail doesn't really matter. Your freedom is still taken away.
Yeah, I think so, too. I'm just imagining, like, it's like, ooh, ah.
Yeah.
I don't think that would actually happen, though. So they added another tower in 1990, and the capacity is still really low. It's only 900 male-only detainees. We don't actually know, like, how many are actually in there. So last year, the Tombs were supposed to close because of their condition, along with Rikers Prison in the Bronx, but they are both currently still open at this time.
Interesting. So they're still, like, in working, like, their people are in prison there right now.
Yeah, I checked, and it says open 24 hours, if anybody is curious. That's what their hours are. Okay.
Side note. What if, when my husband and I were doing, like, road trips, we would see all these, like, random buildings across the, like, on the highways, and we'd be like, oh my gosh, what is that? So we would look it up on our phone, and I feel like 9 out of 10 times it would be this prison in the middle of nowhere. And we started looking up the reviews for the prisons, and they are hilarious. Like, if you ever see a prison, look up the reviews, because they are, like, one of them was, like, the food was not up to my standards here. Like, the lobster and the steak was a little bit overcooked. Like, it's just so funny. Like, I don't know. It's funny stuff. But anyways, not to, like, go to prison. It's not funny. But anyways, I digress.
Yelp reviews.
Continue. All right. Yelp reviews and Google reviews.
Okay, so another notable place is called Blackwell Island. And this place is now known as Roosevelt Island. It housed a lot of, it housed like 3 different buildings at the time. So imagine, like, if you had a bunch of garbage and you thought to yourself, I really wish this garbage was over there. But imagine if the garbage was actually people with mental or physical disabilities or prisoners or people with smallpox. So they called the island a place for incurables. And a penitentiary came first in 1832. And then in 1839, the New York City Lunatic Asylum, first of its kind, began accepting patients.
The Lunatic Asylum. What a good name.
Which was really just like a place for everybody. And they're like, you know what? I really wish these people were on an island because they're bothering me. And so that's what they did, which is horrible.
Mental illness was not a thing back then.
And also, if you're thinking, hey, didn't a female journalist go undercover there to expose the horrible treatment and conditions? Shh, that's for another episode. So sometime after, it was just a women's asylum. And then, like, a long time down the road, it was named Roosevelt Island as a tribute to the police commissioner and president who suffered from polio, like many patients who were ditched there on the island, and also to honor the stories of disabled individuals that played an important role in American history, who are frequently forgotten and left out. All right, so Isabella is married to her husband, who is a police officer. They have 4 children. So Isabella's husband, John, died unexpectedly on August 11th, 1896, at the age of 42. only 11 years into their marriage, leaving Isabella a widow at the age of 30. I looked everywhere for how he died, and all I know is that it said unexpected, so he definitely did not see it coming.
11 years and six kids. That's like her being pregnant every other year.
Yeah.
That's a lot of pregnant years.
And also, when you're a police officer, especially at that time, they were just, I think they were called roundsmen. So they were gone a lot. Mm. I mean, I know like police officers are gone now, but you had like one day off a month.
Really?
It was a lot. So with four children to support on her own, she decided that she would also go work for the NYPD. So women in the prison system. So up until the early 1800s, women and men resided in the same prison cells, which obviously was a problem. One prisoner at Auburn Prison in New York, Rachel Welch, became pregnant by another inmate during a jail sentence. She gave birth to the child and then died, not from childbirth, but by the wounds resulting from a punishment of flogging by prison officials.
Because she got pregnant.
By an inmate. So let's break this down.
Oh my God.
So she was arrested and placed in jail with a bunch of guys. They were all probably super nice. And none of them probably raped her.
Nope.
I'm going to take a guess and say that she was most likely raped. She had to carry
multiple times
a baby full term in 1800s era jail, which I'm kind of just picturing a dungeon in my head. And then she gives birth to a child in jail, which I'm sure is fucking horrific. And then after this, she is beaten to death by a prison official who probably had a ton of fun doing it. Let's be honest.
Who probably also raped her.
Definitely. So private women's groups at this time were starting to become a thing, and they were starting to make a difference. From this case and pressure from women's groups like the American Female Reform Society, they pushed an entirely new idea that prisoners and officials alike should be separated by gender. The Auburn Prison, where Rachel Welch died, hired its first police matron in 1832, and six more were hired in 1845. Two of these matrons worked in the tombs, like I mentioned previously, and the four others were appointed to Blackwell Island's asylum, which, remember, was a female asylum. It was also not uncommon for the department to hire widows of fallen officers to work in the offices. Isabella passed the civil service exam in 1896 and was appointed as police matron by Theodore Roosevelt himself. Police matrons were essentially the first police women in our society today. They were hired in jails to look after female and child prisoners, and they also performed searches of female prisoners. Isabella was paid $1,000 a year and had only one day off a month.
Oh my gosh, that's nothing.
Right? With four kids.
How does she support her children?
I know she lived with her mom after her husband died. So that's, you know, like where her kids were.
That's like, so if she worked, let's say there's 31 days in a month. And she had one, so the one day off, she made $33 a day. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. And those hours were probably at least like 12 hours, right?
Oh yeah. So police matrons were not paid from government funding like other police officials, but from each police department or prison in which they were employed by, or they were also paid for by the reform societies as well. They would have donors that donated money for salaries.
For just the women?
Yeah.
Not the men?
No. Just for the extra, like, ones that the government wouldn't cover. So the role of police matron was distinctly different than those of the male counterparts, and women preferred it that way. They were able to use their caring nature to serve the more vulnerable prison population. In contrast, the role of male officers, who mainly used brute strength and intimidation to uphold the law. After several years...
That's nice.
Yeah. Well, it was really interesting in a lot of these articles. It really shed light on how much women brought to this aspect of police work, because mainly because of their brains, they were able to think differently. After several years, the impact that these women were having on the prison system was noticeable. Therefore, it started becoming a notable job position for women in society between 1910 and 1915. Many different positions within the police departments began to open up for women specifically. A census in 1915 revealed that 25 cities in the country employed police women. Theodore Roosevelt eventually expanded the role of the police matron to not only looking after prisoners, but also aiding with female crime victims and cases involving children.
That's awesome.
So Isabella is a police matron now. She has an official title. And as she's working, she's becoming known for her excellent sleuthing skills. And then she starts working undercover.
What is sleuthing?
Just kind of detective work. So this is the part where her looks came in. So we're going to go through everyone's favorite newspaper segment, how they talked about women.
It's a running theme throughout our entire podcast.
So at 5'1", Isabella had a kind, motherly face. Her dark hair had not yet streaked with gray, and her gray eyes are full of expression and sympathy. A broad forehead denoted intelligence, and her whole manner would lead one to take her for a married woman of the well-to-do class.
Oh.
Not so bad. I mean, the broad forehead thing, I mean, it's a little...
That's odd, but, you know, they did weird things to, like, measure all sorts of things. Remember, like, I forget what movie I was watching, but they, like, measured someone's, like, thumb, and that determined, like, how fertile they were or something. Yeah. Like, it was just, like, the weirdest, like, ways to be like, oh, well, she's gonna have a lot of kids because the way her thumb and nose are.
Look at how big her forehead is. You must be a genius.
Yeah. It's so funny. Okay. Well, not too bad. Not too bad.
It's okay, but it was just the broad forehead really got me. And then you don't have gray hair yet. Once Isabella was assigned to help the detective bureau with cases, she usually went undercover as a naive matron of the high society and helped expose astrologers, Hindu magicians, fortune tellers, healers, and fake surgeons. Which, a fake surgeon? Yikes. That would be, I don't even know where to go with that.
Did they, like, open you up and pretend to do something?
I don't know. Did they knock on your door, like, and just like, hey, do you need any surgery done?
That leg looks like it needs to come off.
We have.
Let's get it done.
Kirby vacuums and, I also have this knife. Another notable operation was when Isabella went undercover as a degenerate gambler to assist in a raid for a woman's only betting parlor.
That's awesome. That there was a woman's only betting parlor.
In her time as a police matron before she became a detective, she helped collect evidence for over 500 culprits in fraud cases.
That's a lot. She did a great job.
Yeah. All right. So now we move on to the big case with Eddie the Boob.
That was his name.
All right. In 1912, on a sunny February morning in Manhattan's financial district, something big happened that would change Isabella's life forever. Eddie the Boob Kinsman decided to rob the East River National Bank of $25,000, which in today's money is over $700,000. And I read conflicting stories about how this whole thing went down, so I kind of wrote it out how it made sense to me. So they robbed the bank and then hijacked a taxi, not before severely beating the taxi driver and his guard, and then getting away. Manhattanites were stunned. And the NYPD had no leads in cracking the case, which went over really well in the press, as you might imagine. I'm sure there were great stories. NYPD has no leads.
Sure,
they're all idiots.
Sure, they're blaming everybody.
Pretty much. Eddie the Boob Kinsman, and I will never stop using his nickname because I love it and it's part of his identity, had a rumored girlfriend.
Why? Why is that his nickname?
I don't
though?
Know. I couldn't, like, find out.
Oh my God. That's so funny. I
know. I
love it. That boob.
So okay. Eddie the Boob had a rumored girlfriend called Sweet Annie Hull. And Sweet Annie Hull lived in a boarding house that I'm sure was lovely. And her roommate slash friend Myrtle Hoyt also lived there with her, obviously, by the term roommate. And when I read about boarding houses, they seem like horrible bed and breakfast that you can, like, never escape. That's just, like, what I picture when I read about these in, like, old stories. So hearing about this rumor of where Annie Sweet was living, Isabella made an offer. She would go undercover at this boarding house as a maid for $6 a week and free rent in a dark, wretched hole under the stairs. Sounds great, right?
Lovely.
Isabella scrubbed floors, cleaned rooms, collected rent, emptied garbages, cooked meals, and ran errands for the boarding house's lodgers. By day, she dressed the part with old clothes like a kimono from her own closet and unkempt hair while completing her daily chores. But by night, she slyly roamed the halls and quietly listened through keyholes, all while sneaking out to report her findings to the NYPD. Finally, through one of these keyholes, she heard Sweet Annie tell Myrtle, "Well, Eddie the Boob turned the trick all right." Isabella knew from her own experience that confiding in the help was something of a common trait in women. So to get more information, she waited. And one day, she saw Myrtle in her room a short time after Annie Sweet's confession, and Myrtle looked extremely upset. So she asked Myrtle what was wrong. And before she knew it, Myrtle Hoyt told her everything. Myrtle was upset because...
Good for her.
I know, right? Myrtle was upset because Annie came back and exclaimed that she had just gotten back from an upstate shopping spree with Eddie, the boob, Kinsman. I can't stop. She had fancy new clothes and even a wad of money as an accessory. But I'm sure she was just like waving around while she told Myrtle, "Myrtle, I'm moving out. Look at my money." So she was moving out immediately to stay in a fancy downtown hotel, and then her and Eddie were heading off to California. Isabella delivered.
Why was she crying?
Because I think she was mad that her friend was abandoning her.
Oh.
And maybe she...
Shoot, I'd be happy for her.
Well, and then like maybe she couldn't even like afford to stay in the boarding house. And probably maybe she accidentally hit her with her wad of money. Who knows? No one knows what happened that day. Isabella delivered the information, and the NYPD staked out Grand Central Station and arrested Eddie, the boob Kinsman, while he was purchasing two tickets to the West Coast. Eddie was charged with highway robbery and assault with attempt to kill and was sentenced to a whopping 3 to 6 years in prison.
That's it? Yeah. Oh my God, that's so funny.
I also like that. Okay, go ahead. Okay, you go first.
I was just going to say, like, if that was you and that was your, let's say that was John who stole everything, like, I would not tell anyone.
Yeah, you're right.
I would, like, that's shitty.
Well, she's kind of a bitch. Like, okay, so she's kind of a bitch, but.
Oh God, I would have your back, 100%.
Yeah, but.
Like, well, I'm coming to see you.
Yeah, but we care about Isabella, and she got the win. That's all the money.
All right.
I just like that Eddie was charged with like actual like highway robbery, because you hear that all the time, like that was highway robbery, but like no, he like actually like it actually was highway robbery. It's not an expression. It was highway robbery.
That's funny.
Isabella Goodwin made the front page for her investigation, and then she was called into the commissioner's office. She was promoted to detective lieutenant, and her salary was more than doubled from $1,000 a year to $2,250 a year. And that day, she...
Still not that much.
I know, but at least it was doubled. I mean, that's pretty good. That day, she became NYPD's first official female detective and was proclaimed the best-known woman sleuth in the United States and Sherlock Holmes with a skirt.
Ooh, some high praise. That's pretty cool.
In 1918, the NYPD hired its first 6 female police officers. They were given handcuffs, revolvers, and a summons book, which I think is like the book that they used to write citations. However, they were not, they didn't have like official uniforms, which I guess is okay because then you just get to like improvise. It's like business casual.
Did they have badges?
Yes.
For all the people that didn't see the video, it was me holding up a badge. Yep.
With the sound effects. Isabella continued to specialize in uncovering fraudulent practices throughout New York's high society, including vice and gambling. And it was said that she helped create the Deputy Commissioner of the Welfare Bureau, which focused on crimes involving women and children. However, the actual head of the bureau was appointed to another woman, which was fine because she was busy. In 1921, Isabella married a man 30 years younger than her, Oscar Seaholm, because why not? And she can do whatever she wants.
Dang, that is cougar.
Right?
That's past Puma. Right? That's cougar.
Right? She continued working after her marriage, which was very uncommon. And at the time of her retirement, she had worked for the NYPD for 30 years. Isabella died of colon cancer on October 26, 1943, at the age of 78. She was laid to rest as Isabella Seaholm in Brooklyn and resides at the Greenwood Cemetery to this day.
Wow. That's really cool. What a cool career she had.
So yeah, so that was Isabella Goodwin, and she was the first NYPD female detective.
That's really cool. It's also really cool that she, you know, got promoted to do that after going undercover and, you know, finding what happened when no one else could.
Yeah, it's so, I think her story is so interesting. If you'd like to read more about Isabella Goodwin, check the sources in the episode description. There's a link to the book, The Fearless Mrs. Goodwin by Elizabeth Mitchell. And her life is also used as an inspiration for the character Sarah Howard in the novel series, of which there are four, and it's also a television show, The Alienist, which there are two seasons of. So it's a show and it's a bunch of books. I watched it on HBO Max, but it's also a TNT series.
Very cool.
So
does the show depict her like marrying a man 30 years younger than her?
No. So Dakota Fanning plays her in the show.
Oh.
So she's super young. It's definitely a different character, but it's very inspired by...
It's like based on her life.
Yeah, pretty much. It's definitely like not
okay.
The same character, because Sarah Howard in the show opens a female detective agency, but like she still works for Theodore Roosevelt at the beginning. So it's like loosely based. It's a really good show. So I highly recommend it. But that inspired me to figure out like, is Sarah Howard real? And then I found Isabella Goodwin.
That's awesome. Yeah. What a cool life story. And also to be, you know, like showing that women can, one, do the job and also do it in a different way that is extremely supportive to the NYPD and just like a different viewpoint. And I just think it's always such a great idea to have, you know, male version, woman version, all the different, you know, both sides for everything.
Yeah.
These people look at things differently, culturally, gender, everything.
Yeah. And I think it was important for me to put in the story the places where the women were first employed, because A, they were so notable and they're such a big part of the history of all of this, like the tombs. Like I still hear that all the time, like in police shows and everywhere, and like how bad they really were. And for women to go in there and be the first women that worked in those places, like the tombs, there were two women that began to work in there. It's just crazy to me. And then especially like Blackwell Island, four women for an entire asylum. That must have been, and you're on an island. Like it was an actual island. Like there, if something horrible happened, there was no escape. And that goes for like the police women that worked there and for, you know, anyone who was sent there too. It's just terrifying to me.
It's like the New York Alcatraz.
Yeah, kind of.
I didn't realize there was another island in New
York. No.
That had a jail either.
It's so crazy. I guess there's only one building that's still standing. But I included pictures that I was hoping would be on our Instagram of the facility, and it was just enormous.
Yeah, I'll put those on Instagram. Yeah, so we'll put the pictures on Instagram, and you'll see them tomorrow.
All right, so I have a couple of interesting things and then something else I want to say. That's how I'm going to word that.
Sounds good.
NYPD in the present. There are currently 6,658 female officers in the NYPD, making up 19% of the force. So
that's pretty good.
It's okay. In the United States as a whole, women make up only about 12% of the police force, while they do represent a majority of the departmental staff at 67%, which I think is kind of interesting. I like that the NYPD is higher than the national average. And I do think it's really cool that like the police departments are kind of mostly ran by women, which also makes sense to me because, we're good at stuff.
But I also think for the Golden State Killer, I forget her name, the woman who was the detective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She, like, having a woman on your staff as a detective, I think is huge, especially for, you know, rape victims or anything with children. It's just like I feel like there's this level of connection that automatically is kind of established with women.
Yeah. And I think that is a really important thing to note about why they originally hired women, is because they did realize that they had a special place that could be very, very beneficial to the police department and in the prisons.
And it's not that men can't do that. I've definitely seen male police officers be able to connect, but I just think there's this like level of being open to women.
Yeah, like a female, just like energy.
You know, just the aura, of being a female.
So I just brought up a little comparison of the United Kingdom, and 31% or a little bit over 40,000 police officers are female. And also females make up a majority of the departmental staff in the UK.
That's awesome.
So we have it's definitely higher there. And then a couple notable police women, notable. In 1984, Irma Lozada was the first female officer shot and killed in the line of duty. In 1992, Detective Karen Ingdahl became the first female officer assigned to the bomb squad. And in 1994, Captain Joyce A. Steffen became the first African-American woman to become a commanding officer of a precinct. And it was the 28th precinct of Manhattan. And then finally, in 2003, Joanne Jaff became the highest-ranking female officer in the NYPD to date by being appointed chief of the Housing Bureau.
That's awesome.
All right. I'm going to rant. I'm going to rant for a second.
Go.
All right.
Get it, mama.
Even though in this story we saw many historic wins for women, both in the police and in the prison system, by women being appointed on the force, and also as caregivers in prisons, sexual abuse still occurs in prisons to this day. According to a CNN article, women inmates are 3.5 times more likely to experience sexual abuse and harassment than men. Although in many states, guards and prisoners are separated by gender, it is not always the case, like in Rikers Prison of New York. Women inmates who have been subject to these conditions and attacks are often suppressed in reporting, and if they do file a complaint, oftentimes their abuser is still able to remain at their post, even still guarding their own victims while the victim suffers threats and retaliation. Also, I use the word victim in this, which normally isn't my favorite word for sexual abuse. I normally like to use survivor of sexual assault, but in my opinion, survivor denotes that the situation or the attack has ended, and for many of these women, they are still in it. Women who are able to successfully file lawsuits often have been impregnated by guards and even infected with sexually transmitted diseases.
It's so sad.
So it's definitely still happening today, and it's something I think with police reform that needs to still be addressed, because there's a lot of people still suffering.
Yeah, especially I just feel like when there's a level of like power over someone else, whoever the victim is, male, female, it's that level of having power over that person. And when people are put in that situation and they are not a good person, that's when rape happens. Mm-hmm. And it just, to me, the positions of power should be really put through like a psych evaluation, because that is the stuff that can be, you know, prevented by someone who has a psyche eval and goes through questions about that. Like, it just, I do not understand positions in power that take advantage of other people.
I also think this is something that John and I were talking about today, and even
John is her husband, by the way.
That guy, John Goodwin. I was speaking beyond the grave.
Yes.
John, my husband. We were talking about all of this today, and he brought up the Stanford prison experiment, and how quickly, when that experiment started, if you don't know, it was an experiment at Stanford. Half the students were inmates and half the students were guards. Anyway, it got ugly quick. Like, the power dynamic, I think it was within, if I'm remembering this correctly, and I'm probably not, it was in like 4 hours. Like, the power dynamic began to flip. And it was crazy how the level that it ended up at and how insane it got. And just like how quickly, just from saying like, hey, okay, you guys are in charge of these people. That was it. And then it got messy real quick. And I just think that it's almost just this disease that comes over you of just like, oh, I'm in charge now. And the little switch in your head flips.
I love that experiment, but it was like so beyond. That was one, like, okay, so that experiment, there were several like psychological experiments that happened in multiple different colleges that created what our ethics are today for like psychological experiments. Mm-hmm. And that was one of them that like majorly messed up like the people that were involved in it. And that part, they needed to have like this full-blown like session after to explain like what happened to them and like why it happened. And the damage was done already to the people that were in power that treated the victims or the prisoners like crap. So that stuff like that cannot be done anymore.
Yeah.
Like experiments like that, they are unethical. But what we learned from that experiment is crazy. Yeah, there's some really good like YouTube videos on it if you haven't seen it. Yeah, speaking of how like that switch just flips when people get power given to them. And that's why I just feel like there has to be so much education for people in power.
Yeah.
Because it's like that leadership development and understanding.
Yeah.
If you don't understand that, and if you don't understand like how to digest that, how to treat other people, and how police officers, anyone in like CEO leaderships, like it can be done on every single platform. If you don't have that education, oh, it can turn really bad.
Mm-hmm. And we see, I mean, not even in the prison system, we see it in so many examples. I mean, I'm currently watching Ronan Farrow's documentary on HBO Max. He's the one that broke the case about Harvey Weinstein. Even Harvey Weinstein, like, he was just so in power. And it was a huge, like, secret. Like, he got so many people to stay silent. And he was a horrible, horrible person. And he ruined a lot of lives and sexually assaulted so many women. It's just, like, you can find an example everywhere.
Yeah, every industry, there's examples of this happening.
I think one of the most important things that we can do is to just keep calling it out and not forgetting and just keeping it in the ether, because once everyone falls silent is like when they have the okay to continue.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that psych experiment, really, really awesome.
Yeah, it's a good one to look up if you've never heard about it. So anyway, thank you for listening to my TED Talk.
Well, good job. Thank you. I never heard of her before. Also, not something that I would have like thought about doing, because I guess I wouldn't have thought about like how women even got involved in NYPD.
There are so many other stories, and I kind of want to do them down the road, because I just kept finding a story after story after story of different like little tangents and other women. And there's so many interesting other women that I would like to cover too. So stay tuned, because cool. I might be on a tangent.
Stay tuned.
All right. So who is your girl crush for this week?
So I have actually two girl crushes. They are
the same.
I know. I'm sorry. It's two, but it's the same thing. So they are called the Salmon Sisters. And salmon as in like the fish. So, and again, you missed my hand motions. It's me swimming.
A very, very credible motion.
This is a salmon, Alexa.
I see. It's swimming upstream. I can tell. I can tell just by how hard your hand is working.
See the little jumps it's doing too? You know?
It's very inventive.
Anyways, I hope you all are visualizing this with us.
All right, just hold out your hand and then you just wave it like it's going upstream.
Wiggle.
Okay.
Wiggle, wiggle. Oh, Lord. Okay. So the Salmon Sisters is Rhonda and run by co-founder Fisherman, which it should be Fisherwoman, but
Fisher,
you know,
people.
Fisher people. And so it's the co-founders and Fisherman and sisters, Emma and Claire. So their whole team is all women, which I think is amazing. So they are out of Alaska. They have an incredible cookbook. That's how I found out who they were. I bought their cookbook and just talks about how they grew up on a homestead in Alaska and goes through like their childhood and how they grew up working on commercial fishing boats. They smoke the salmon and they like candy salmon and they also sell that on their website. They sell like the frozen salmon and fresh everything like that. So I just think their company is really cool. I just find it fascinating that like they have an all-woman fishing staff. And I feel like that's something you don't really hear about very often. So, and you know, they do all the other cool things like sustainable fishing and, you know, wild caught and sourced.
In water.
Good. I don't know. Sourced with
water.
What is it called? Sourced with water. It's like ethical sourcing or whatever. I forget what the term is. I think it's called ethical sourcing.
Why is it? This should be a TV show. Why is this on a TV show?
They should have a TV show for this. Yeah. Yeah. And they do halibut for the hell of it. That's a fish slapper. I'm gonna stop now. Anyways, so that's my girl crushes. I just think their company is really cool.
Really cool. Also, yeah, that definitely needs to be a TV show.
It does, yeah. So they're out there, like they literally are the ones catching the fish, which I think is really cool too. Like this is what they grew up
doing. That's awesome.
So I'm on their website right now. So free domestic standard shipping over $75. Just saying. So if you buy some fish.
And the website is called? Shipping.
AKSalmonSisters.com. So like AlaskanSalmonSisters.com. It's cool. I think their company is cool. Their cookbook is really cool too. So
my girl crush, I'm going to preface this by like, I'm not like an Olympics person. I don't really watch them that much, but still support Simone Biles, who is a 4-time Olympic gold medalist for the United States, withdrew from the Tokyo Olympics suddenly after she had a really bad vault. And so she decided that she was not in the right headspace and decided to step back from the competition. That must be such a hard decision to make, but for her to realize that her mental health was making her performance suffer and realize that she needed to take a step back is really brave, and I'm really proud of her for doing that.
I mean, that couldn't have been an easy decision to make, and I still think she's just so incredible. And there, for all the Olympics, athletes, their training has been so messed up with COVID.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who is upset that she backed out of the Olympics or something, like, really? And also, do you forget that these are people? Like, they're athletes, but they are also human beings that they're just like everybody else, and they suffer like everybody else, and they can also suffer from mental health issues like everybody else. So I think it's just important to realize that, you know, things like this happen. And for her to be able to be on like such a high national platform and to be able to say that's super brave. Well, let's get out of here.
One thing that I did want to say is thank you so much for the people who are supporting our podcast, our fans, our family and friends, and people that are reaching out on Instagram and email. We love you guys. And thank you for doing this ride with us.
Thank you so much.
I guess we're out. So thank you for listening to Girl Power History. History is her story.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to our dear friends Carly and Dylan Peterson for creating our theme song and show music. You can follow their band Valentine on Spotify and on social media
at Valentine the Band. Visit our show description for sources and episode links. Email us at hello@girlpowerhistory.com and follow us on all social media platforms at Girl Power History.